American Petro-Imperialism. Old-fashioned colonialists, regal and unembarrassed, took physical control of territories, sent in ostrich-plumed governors, minted coins, and printed local postage stamps on which kings or queens gazed proudly over scenes of natives cutting cocoa pods or harvesting tea. By contrast, petro-imperialism, the key aspect of which is the U.S. military's transformation into a global oil protection force, puts up a democratic facade, emphasizes freedom of the seas, or pipeline routes, and seeks to secure, protect, drill, and ship oil, not administer everyday affairs. Still, the way in which the United States has begun to organize its national security and military posture around oil is hardly new in spirit, albeit unprecedented in scope. Nations have always been concerned about resources vital for fuel or war-making capacity. In the 17th and 18th centuries, that meant timber and naval stores, tar, turpentine, and the like, which explained both the Dutch and the British preoccupation with access to the Baltic. In the mid-17th century, the Dutch ambassador to Denmark bragged of his nation's fleet that the oaken keys of the Sound, between Denmark and Sweden, lie in the docks of Amsterdam. Similarly, between 1658 and 1814, British squadrons were sent some 20 times to maintain the freedom of that sound. The future United States was also a naval supply yard. By the middle of the 18th century, Britain obtained many of the towering masts so vital to the Royal Navy's line of battle from giant pine trees in colonial Maine, then still a part of Massachusetts. Bureaucracy as well as profit was generated by marking, protecting, cutting, and transporting the king's trees to which the crown paid real attention. Towns had to be laid out with oddly angled roads and central greens to permit passage of the huge trees. One such angle is still visible in the colonial-era center of Freeport, Maine, on the tidal and accessible Harrisiquit River. In switching to coal and steam in the 19th century, navies also pursued a minor league carbon imperialism, the establishment by Britain and other powers of global networks of coaling stations. The United States set up a half dozen in the Pacific, and the British had scores in both hemispheres. British historian Neil Ferguson, in his book Empire, contended that a map showing the principal U.S. military bases around the world looks remarkably like a map of Royal Navy coaling stations 100 years ago. Compared with the developments of latter-day petro-imperialism, however, the coaling stations were one-dimensional. Regions were not seized for coal deposits. Small bits of territory were merely leased as facilities for use in providing warships with coal, usually brought in from elsewhere. A better analogy to today's American practice can be found in the client oil states set up by the British after World War I. To Lord Curzon, the optimum was an Arab facade ruled and administered under British guidance and controlled by a native Mohammedan and, as far as possible, by an Arab staff. There should be no actual incorporation of the conquered territory in the dominions of the conqueror, but the absorption may be veiled by such constitutional fictions as a protectorate, a sphere of influence, a buffer state, and so on. He might have been speaking of post-2003 occupied Iraq. What's different about current U.S. petro-imperialism is that the leading world economic power, whose idiosyncratic fuel base is petroleum, is also the nation worried, for good reason, about running out of oil. By contrast, when the declining Britain of 1919 to 1953 was belatedly chasing oil, with only partial success, its home economy was still more than 90% dependent on coal, almost all of it locally mined. Besides which, Britain's principal ally, the United States, was the world's leading oil and military power. As of the 2000s, by contrast, the United States has no cousinly power dominant in hydrogen or natural gas production. As a consequence, the whole Western world power continuum that has more or less controlled global trade and finance since the 1600s could yield to the rise of Asian countries. With this changing picture, it's not surprising that the linkage of oil and national security took on new dimensions. In 1992, after the Gulf War, then Secretary of Defense Cheney gave Halliburton, the energy services company, a contract to study the privatization of some Pentagon functions. The company duly reported back and obtained more funding to, in essence, design its own broader opportunity. In 1993, after George H.W. Bush had been defeated for re-election, Cheney briefly pondered a 1996 presidential race of his own, but withdrew and in 1995 took the post of chief executive officer at Halliburton. Thereafter, he led a steadily expanding enterprise. Brown & Root had been acquired decades earlier, but the purchase of Dresser Industries in 1998 doubled Halliburton's size into a path-breaking role. The company became a major federal energy war contractor and, partly because of Cheney's connections, a private sector bridge between the oil industry and the military-industrial complex. Another transformational company of the 90s, likewise manned by prominent figures from the departing Bush administration, George H.W. Bush himself and Secretary of State James A. Baker III, was the Carlyle Group, partly funded by rich Saudi investors. Military and Pentagon contractors were conspicuous on the list of Carlyle subsidiaries. One was the Vinnell Corporation, close to the CIA, which held contracts to train the security and internal police forces of countries including Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Other contractors unrelated to Carlyle went even further, providing thinly disguised mercenaries and paramilitary forces for unofficial operations overseas. Despite the threats of 1973 to 1975, it took oil nearly two more decades to become a reason for direct U.S. military intervention overseas, as opposed to CIA-led overthrows or large arms sales. The occasion was Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait and the 1991 U.S.-led war for its expulsion from there. Saddam Hussein had told U.S. officials beforehand that his invasion was based on oil-related provocations. First, Kuwait's alleged slant drilling of Iraqi oil fields just over the border, and second, the Kuwaiti efforts through OPEC to drive down oil prices to deny Iraq the revenues supposedly needed to rebuild after eight draining years of war with Iran. Once the United States decided to eject Iraq from Kuwait, however, Saddam's rationales became irrelevant. When President Bush mobilized American forces, he commented matter-of-factly that our jobs, our way of life, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of Saddam Hussein. Secretary of Defense Cheney was even more vociferous. Once he, Saddam, acquired Kuwait and deployed an army as large as the one he possesses, Cheney argued, the Iraqi leader was in a position to be able to dictate the future of worldwide energy policy, and that gave him a stranglehold on our economy. Compared with the pretenses of 2002 to 2003, these statements were relatively candid. It was not only in and around the Persian Gulf that oil dominated American foreign policy. Bush's decision to intervene in Somalia in late 1992, supposedly for humanitarian reasons, was later proved by the investigative journalism of the Los Angeles Times to have been substantially oil-driven. Four large U.S. oil firms, Chevron, Amoco, Conoco, and Phillips, had exclusive concessions covering two-thirds of Somalia that were put at risk when the nation's pro-Western government was overthrown. Although the U.S. government spoke of peacekeeping and company spokesmen denied motivations of oil rather than of humanitarian relief as absurd and nonsense, the newspaper noted that Bush himself in 1986 had dedicated a Texas-run oil facility in nearby Yemen, an occasion when he emphasized regional oil development. Equally to the point, Conoco had allowed its corporate compound in Mogadishu to be made into a de facto U.S. embassy a few days before the Marines landed in the capital. These circumstances, the Times concluded, led many to liken the Somalia operation to a miniature version of Operation Desert Storm. Oil-based foreign policy persisted under Bush's Democratic successor, Bill Clinton. Captivated by mid-90s assessments of the energy potential of the Caspian Sea region, Clinton in 1995 announced strategic partnerships with Uzbekistan and several other newly independent republics in former Soviet Central Asia. Several U.S. companies had already negotiated oil or gas deals with Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. In a 1998 book, The Grand Chessboard, Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former Democratic White House national security advisor, touted the Caspian and Central Asia as a strategic pivot in much the same way Britain's Mackinder had before World War I. Brzezinski's strategic recommendations, to be sure, had a more specific oil and gas focus. Because the landlocked Caspian was inaccessible to oil and gas tankers, pipelines became an early petro-imperial focus. Along with Britain's Blair, Clinton became a patron of the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. He also promoted a route from the Black Sea across the Balkans to Albania. Meanwhile, General Anthony Zinni, the U.S. CENTCOM, Middle Eastern commander, opened military conversations with the new republics. By the time Clinton left office in January 2001, he could point to other minor Kipling-esque innovations. The Silk Road Strategy Act of 1999 and the April 2000 launching of the Central Asian Border Security Initiative. But by 2002, oil companies drilling in the Caspian and finding little began to conclude that its energy potential had been overblown. In 1997 to 1998, observers had generally dismissed petroleum-related interpretations of Clinton's commitment of U.S. military forces to the Balkans. The principal allegation was that European and U.S. intervention was really about making southern portions of the former Yugoslavia safe for pipelines bringing Caspian oil from Bulgaria on the Black Sea to Albania on the Adriatic. In 2002, the Asia Times offered an even broader indictment. All countries or regions which happen to be an impediment to Pipelinistan routes towards the West have been subjected either to a direct interference or to all-out war. Chechnya, Georgia, Kurdistan, Yugoslavia, and Macedonia. Few in the West listened. In fact, oil transportation considerations must have always lurked in the background. Late 2004 saw Albania, Macedonia, and Bulgaria sign a pact to begin the Trans-Balkans pipeline's construction. Much of the financing came from the U.S. government's overseas private investment corporation and private American firms, as originally proposed in 1996, when the corridor involved had been laid out as part of the Clinton administration's South Balkan Development Initiative. Whatever Clinton's expectations for the Caspian, he more than maintained the oil-related status quo in Iraq. He launched major attacks with aircraft and cruise missiles in January 1996, June 1996, and December 1998. He deployed troops near Iraq's borders in 1997 and 1998, Operations Phoenix Scorpion and Desert Thunder, after Baghdad had proposed oil concessions to Russia, China, and France. And on October 31st, he signed the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, calling for regime change in Baghdad. 2 months earlier, Clinton had signed another finding, PL-105-235, that accused Iraq of building weapons of mass destruction, failing to cooperate with the United Nations, and being immaterial and unacceptable breach of its international obligations. This insistence, as we have seen, was essential to keeping Saddam Hussein hogtied by UN sanctions and thus unable to implement the French, Russian, and Chinese concessions. For boldness, though, none of the Clinton-era actions could compare with the far-reaching great game propositions of the one-time strategists for the first Bush administration gathered around Cheney and the project for a new American century. Regime change in Iraq became code for a second invasion. The Bush-Cheney administration, on taking office, embraced an oil-forward strategy with instant intensity. Plans were discussed in the spring and summer of 2001, well before the events of September, for hamstringing Iraq and convincing the Taliban in Afghanistan to accept construction of an American Unocal pipeline from Turkmenistan through Kabul to Karachi, Pakistan. Talks with the Taliban continued in the summer of 2001, but apparently soon collapsed. Duplicity seems to have been in the catbird seat. Multiple press reports from sources in Pakistan and elsewhere, all officially denied in Washington, had the American government planning to attack Afghanistan sometime in the autumn. Then the world changed. Besides intensifying existing oil and Middle Eastern pressures, on September 11th, the attack on the World Trade Center gave Washington policies a convenient new all-inclusive justification. Fighting terror was about everything, and everything was about fighting terror. Oil motivations, rarely a popular or easy foreign policy justification, could now be submerged within a primal response to a deep-seated national combination of fear, loathing, and outrage. Petroleum strategy could now become only a minor facet of an anti-terrorist mobilization. In the wake of September 11th, hardly anyone made the argument, which would be widespread by 2004, that America's oil quest and tactics had been provocative in the Middle East. This was especially true of the placement since 1990 of non-believer U.S. troops on the holy Saudi Arabian soil to which devout Muslims have made centuries of pilgrimages. Occasionally, the blurring of distinctions between energy, anti-terror, and military considerations in U.S. policymaking were obliquely acknowledged. In 2003, former White House speechwriter David Frum wrote in his Bush political biography, The Right Man, that the war on terror was designed to bring new stability to the most vicious and violent quadrant of the earth, and new prosperity to us all, by securing the world's largest pool of oil. CENTCOM, EURCOM, and OILCOM? In 2004, Michael Clare, a theorist of the global resumption of resource wars, summed up the increasingly obvious. Oil, no longer a mere commodity, had become a national security matter, thereby falling under the purview of the Department of Defense and warranting protection at any cost, including the use of military force. Oil-premised military commitments, he argued, were being conflated with the war on terror. Anti-terrorism and the protection of oil supplies are closely related in administration thinking. When requesting funds in 2004 to establish a rapid reaction brigade in Kazakhstan, for example, the State Department told Congress that such a force is needed to enhance Kazakhstan's capability to respond to major terrorist threats to oil platforms in the Caspian Sea. Notably, Condoleezza Rice, who as Bush's national security advisor dwelt on terrorism, had made her commercial bones during the 1990s as a director of Chevron with a specialty in Kazakhstan negotiations. Others pointed to the changing dispositions of the U.S. military, notwithstanding their minimal amplification in the Pentagon's 2003 Global Posture Review. To sticklers, the 2003 report understated the new oil and gas preoccupation by omitting de facto bases in Afghanistan, Central Asia, the Balkans, and the Persian Gulf. From West Africa to the Strait of Malacca, evidence aplenty suggested that future U.S. base locations would be tied to oil resources and oil transport considerations. Several commentators used the term base mania to describe the string of installations guarding the pipeline corridors and oil production centers of the new imperial frontier. Misleadingly catalogued by the Pentagon or not, the transformations were legion. SOUTHCOM, the U.S. Forces' Southern Command, had units in Colombia protecting Occidental Petroleum's interest in the Caño Limón pipeline. Colombian National Forces, scheduled for similar pipeline duty, subsidized by U.S. military aid, were training under U.S. Army Special Forces personnel at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. EURCOM, the European Command, supervised U.S. forces instructing the military of the Caucasian Republic of Georgia on how to protect the soon-to-be-completed pipeline from Baku through Georgia en route to the Turkish coast. By 2003, Pentagon officials, also under the rubric of fighting terror, had begun to talk about permanent bases in Senegal, Ghana, and Mali in West Africa, the latter being another rising oil region under EURCOM jurisdiction. According to the Wall Street Journal, a key mission for U.S. forces in Africa would be to ensure that Nigeria's oil fields, which in the future could account for as much as 25% of all U.S. oil imports, are secure. That summer, General Charles Wald, the deputy EURCOM commander, visited oil-producing Gabon and the potential oil center of São Tomé, where the United States was contemplating constructing a naval base and paying for feasibility studies on the construction of a deep-water port. General James Jones, the EURCOM commander, announced that Navy carrier battle groups would shorten future visits to the Mediterranean and spend half the time going down the west coast of Africa. Like so much about oil, Jones's preoccupation can best be understood by looking at a map, where Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, São Tomé and Príncipe, Congo, and Angola cluster along or near West Africa's Atlantic coast. São Tomé's importance, the islands have become a U.S. focal point, lies in the output expected as international oil companies explore and develop promising offshore fields in the waters between these islands and Nigeria. Controllable by U.S. naval power, West Africa and its waters could be a middling rival to OPEC, or at least it could help stave off a supply crisis for another 4 to 6 years. Pacific Command headquarters, in turn, announced plans to deploy a small boat squadron to protect oil shipping in the Strait of Malacca, the strategic waterway between Malaysia and Sumatra that opens into the South China Sea near Singapore. Sometimes the troops deployed are hirelings. In Indonesia, Exxon paid the expenses of local forces guarding the company's large gas fields in Aceh, northern Sumatra. Local residents called them Exxon's army. CENTCOM, the Florida-based controller for most of the Middle East, had its AOR, Area of Responsibility, broadened in 1997 to include the oil-rich Caspian Basin. Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Several became home to U.S. facilities set up after September 11th. Khanabad in Uzbekistan and the Manas Air Force Base in Kyrgyzstan. Such redeployments, Michael Clare wrote, lead to an inescapable conclusion, that the American military is being used more and more for the protection of overseas oil fields and the supply routes that connect them to the United States and its allies. Such endeavors, once largely confined to the Gulf area, are now being extended to unstable oil regions in other parts of the world. Slowly but surely, the U.S. military is being converted into a global oil protection service. Under these circumstances, somewhere near the office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon's E-ring, one can hypothesize a top-secret overall command center boasting the shorthand for Ultimate Petro Responsibility, OILCOM. Hardly anyone expects these priorities to be temporary. Over the coming decades, the United States, if it remains unchastened, seems sure to require even greater quantities of imported oil, the bulk from countries that are hostile or at least potentially unstable. The latter description fits many presumed exporters: Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Venezuela, Colombia, Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea, Angola, Indonesia, and conceivably Russia. Just as in two world wars, oil supplies and transports will need to be guarded, this time as they flow toward the United States. In a series of reports, the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies has acknowledged this political hazard. Outside the Gulf region, which has its own medieval characteristics, many vital oil suppliers share the characteristics of petrostates, whereby their extreme dependence on income from energy exports distorts their political and economic institutions, centralizes wealth in the hands of the state, and makes each country's leaders less resilient in dealing with change, but provides them with sufficient resources to hope to stave off necessary reforms indefinitely. Unfortunately, oil has been corrosive across much of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Besides fueling deeply rooted antagonisms among ethnic and religious groups clumped together within artificial ex-colonial boundaries, as in Nigeria and Indonesia, sudden infusions of petroleum wealth into poor countries matter-of-factly promote corruption, cronyism, civil war, or the emergence of strongmen. And from West Africa to the Red Sea and the Caspian, companies have proved quite willing to employ bribery and corruption, promote civil violence, or even encourage war. Outside of North American or European countries where some form of democracy previously existed, it has never sprouted from an oil derrick or developed under the tutelage of ExxonMobil, BP, or Halliburton. To characterize the 2002 political milieu of Gabon, an International Monetary Fund working paper used the title Escaping the Curse of Oil? In the petro-imperial age, this prospect seems daunting. Iraq, multiple constituencies and special interest countdowns. The deceit-cloaked invasion of Iraq in 2003 may never command a full or satisfactory explanation. Nevertheless, a near-final decision to invade seems to have been made in early 2001 for reasons that had mounted steadily since 1997. Vice President Cheney, with his successive positions at the junction of the business and government pipelines connecting oil, national politics, and the Pentagon, must have played a pivotal role. Indeed, this triple expertise may explain the July 2000 decision to slate him as George W. Bush's running mate. During the election year and 2001, five political and policy endgames, all felt by important constituencies to be pressing or even desperate, appeared to be underway in the United States, historically an extraordinary convergence. The first was a rising preoccupation on the part of oil geologists and among some thinkers in Washington that not only had American oil production peaked, but global oil production outside of OPEC might be within 5 to 10 years of doing so. To believers, this demanded action. The American oil giants and their lesser compatriots also had corporate time sensitivities. Concerned over slackening new oil discoveries, the big companies feared that their futures depended on whether U.S. or foreign firms obtained access to the huge, barely tapped, and pivotal reserves of Iraq. Huge profits were at stake. A third set of jitters involved finance. A handful of Americans, aware of the interplay of oil and currency flows, worried about OPEC's potential threat to the dollar. Their fear was that should the cartel decide to end the American currency's virtual monopoly on oil pricing, the dollar would plummet, sending shudders through the U.S. economy and its overextended debt structure. Indeed, Iraqi, Iranian, and Venezuelan currency maneuvers were already visible as the dollar sagged in late 2002. Climatologists pondered a fourth countdown. Many contended that soaring 20th century use of hydrocarbon fuels had poured carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at a rate that was responsible for major global climate change. In 2002, the U.S. Defense Department's internal think tank, the Office of Net Assessment, commissioned a dire case evaluation, published a year later under the title An Abrupt Climate Change Scenario and Its Implications for United States National Security. Critical time frames as near as 2010 to 2020 were pondered. Immediate crisis planning was recommended. The fifth clock watch, very different, was a matter of Christian faith, not scientific calculus. As the millennium itself came and went, 40% or more of American Christians continued to tell poll takers in 2000 and 2001 that they expected the biblical prophecies of Armageddon and the end times to come true. They saw day-to-day confirmation of their beliefs in the intensifying Middle Eastern wars, the battling over Israel and Persian Gulf oil, unusual natural disasters, and the rise of AIDS. By 2003, a popular website, RaptureReady.com, listed the top four rapture signals as natural disasters, global terrorism, the formation of the European Union, and unrest in the Middle East. Conservative politicians understood that for true believers, their imminent rapture and the subsequent second coming of Jesus Christ were the only endgame. We can estimate that for 20 to 30% of Christians, this chronology superseded or muted other issues. Because the National Republican Coalition included some 70 to 80% of all three electoral constituencies, energy producers and conspicuous, mostly auto-driving energy consumers, upper bracket wealth holders and financiers, and fundamentalist, Pentecostal, and evangelical Christians, GOP strategists tended to be especially alert to their agendas. The tricky part was that the three groups responded to very different levels of candor, economic greed, and biblical preoccupation. Invading Iraq to secure oil supplies or help ExxonMobil might please the petroleum clubs of the urban Gulf Coast, but it would misfire in the nearby Pentecostal Assemblies of God and biblically intense Sunbelt suburban megachurches. Such preachers rarely read Petroleum Weekly or the Wall Street Journal, but some did a brisk side business in Sunday broadcast syndication and End Times videos. Putting together an invade Iraq domestic constituency was not easy for George H.W. Bush in 1990 to 1991, nor was it easy for George W. Bush in 2001 to 2002. However, Dick Cheney, who had been the elder Bush's defense secretary from 1989 to 1992, became the man, thanks to his unusual combination of skills in military affairs, invading Iraq, 1991, global petroleum issues, and U.S. domestic politics. Some oil watchers later contended that Cheney let the cat out of the Iraqi invasion bag in a 1999 speech to the London Institute of Petroleum. He observed, "By some estimates, there will be an average of 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with conservatively a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves. That means by 2010 we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day." He did not mention Iraq or dwell on the mechanics of oil decline, but the heavy emphasis he placed on gas resource development belied any upbeat expectations. How much Cheney drew on this 1999 awareness in his 2001 Task Force strategic deliberations over U.S. energy policy and the possible role of Iraq's oil fields may never be clear. The extent to which participants have remained silent is reflected in Texas investment banker Matthew Simmons's 2005 book, Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. A sometime advisor to George W. Bush and a member of Cheney's task force, Simmons describes U.S. reliance on Saudi Arabia and the Saudis' claims of being able to increase its oil production to 15 million barrels per day and deliver them for 50 years as a pipe dream. He says Saudi oil production has already peaked and $100 per barrel oil is on the way. His book does not even mention Bush, Cheney, Iraq, or any of their decisions, which may be appropriate, but there is one mention, page 329, of Halliburton, Cheney's old company, and the ultra-sophisticated technology that it and Schlumberger have provided Saudi Aramco for recovering previously bypassed oil. This helps to support Simmons's point about Saudi weakness, but perhaps Cheney's own early sense of that potential exhaustion helped to spur a 2001 to 2002 U.S. targeting of Iraq as a successor to Saudi Arabia, both in terms of oil and as a military platform for controlling the Middle East. These dour assumptions followed the analysis, without the professional jargon, of geological publications that had stirred sharp debate over the previous few years. British geologist Colin Campbell's book, The Coming Oil Crisis, came out in 1997. Then a related article, The End of Cheap Oil, by Campbell and fellow geologist Jean Leherrier, appeared in Scientific American in 1998. More oil peak expositions followed in 2000 and 2001. Like other senior oil executives, Cheney cut to the chilling bottom-line implications. This peak scenario pessimism squared with individual companies' oil and gas exploration reports. As we saw in Chapter 1, by 2000, North America's aging resources were clearly depleting. More and more wells in Texas had to be drilled just to keep production constant. Reuters later reported the belief that Canadian gas output had peaked in 2001 to 2002. Even as Cheney spoke in 1999, top executives at Royal Dutch, Shell, and British Petroleum must have been hearing about shortfalls in exploration and reserves that became public knowledge in 2002. By 2003, experts had described ExxonMobil's production as flat since 1999. The 1997 to 1998 reports of foreign rivals angling for Iraq concessions would have magnified the fears of U.S. and British oil executives who read or even half-believed Campbell, Le Harrier, and their colleagues. All of this would have backstopped a 2000 to 2002 sense of Iraq as solution. Come the new administration, few energy insiders would have been surprised when Cheney took the point. By early 2001, the situation he had addressed in 1999 had substantially worsened. It was now known that in 1998, the United States, for the first time, had imported more than half of the petroleum it consumed. Data for 2001 showed the United States having surpassed Europe as an importer of Middle Eastern oil. The winter of 2000 to 2001 had seen natural gas prices spike in the United States, while oil prices jumped to $30 per barrel. Charged with interweaving energy policy and national security, Cheney's team ranged far afield. No transcripts exist, and few public explanations have come from those involved. But Paul Roberts, in The End of Oil, contended that in the spring of 2001, Cheney and other strategists pored over maps of Iraqi oil fields to estimate how much Iraqi oil might be dumped quickly on the market. Before the war, Iraq had been producing 3.5 million barrels a day, and many in the industry and the administration believed that the volume could easily be increased to 7 million by 2010. If so, and if Iraq could be convinced to ignore its OPEC quota and start producing at maximum capacity, the flood of new oil would effectively end OPEC's ability to control prices. As supply expanded, prices would fall dramatically, and not even the Saudis, with their crying revenue needs, would be able to cut production deeply enough to stop the slide. Caught between falling revenues and escalating debts, the Saudis, too, would be forced to open their oil fields to Western oil companies, as would other OPEC countries. Naive as this seems in retrospect, it may have been Cheney's hope. He certainly understood the U.S. oil industry's anxiety. Prime Minister Blair's government, ever intimate with British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell, would have had a similar set of concerns. BP, mindful of oil resource depletion, was already preoccupied enough with alternative fuels to take on yet another nickname, Beyond Petroleum. After the Iraq War, Blair's environment minister, Michael Meacher, who had resigned in protest, described the clouds gathering in British energy skies. 4 months ago, autumn 2003, Britain's oil imports overtook its exports, underlining a decline in North Sea oil production that was already well underway. North Sea oil output peaked at about 2.9 million barrels per day in 1999 and has been predicted to fall to only 1.6 million BPD by 2007. Like many others, Meacher also cited the estimates made by the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas and was glum about the chance of meeting the expanded global need Cheney had cited in 1999. The former British minister summed up, "These late 2003 calculations place the coming oil crunch sometime between 2010 and 2015, perhaps earlier. The reserves in the world's supergiant and giant oil fields are dwindling at an average rate of 4 to 6% a year. No more big frontier regions remain to be explored except the North and South Poles. The production of non-conventional crude oil has already been initiated at enormous cost in Venezuela's Orinoco Belt and Canada's Athabasca tar sands and ultra-deep waters. Yet no major primary energy alternative can replace oil and gas in the short to medium term." While the constituency pressures pushing Bush, Blair, Cheney, and Rumsfeld toward war were evident, the endgame urgings of the major U.S. oil corporations were less clear. Although the giant firms left many partial fingerprints on task forces and meetings later officially denied by the White House, even critics differed over what the corporations sought. The money, prestige, and reserves at stake were beyond dispute. Were ExxonMobil, Chevron Texaco, BP, and Royal Dutch Shell to divide up Iraq, their receipts over several decades would be in the trillions of dollars. Although no oil company or government estimates were made public, James Paul of the Global Policy Forum offered these estimates. Iraq's oil is the world's cheapest to produce, at a cost of only about $1 per barrel. The gigantic rent on Iraq's oil during decades of production could yield company profits in the range of $4 to $5 trillion. Assuming 50 years of production and 40% royalties, Iraq could yield annual profits of $80 to $90 billion per year, more than the total annual profits of the top five companies, even in the banner year of 2003. Such a windfall would have sent oil companies' stock prices soaring. In January 2004, when Royal Dutch Shell had to reduce its worldwide reserve estimates by 20%, from 19.3 billion barrels to 15.4 billion, its stock and market capitalization immediately dropped by 7%. Were any of the giants to get long-term control of one of the 15 to 30 billion barrel Iraqi fields, even that large a company could roughly double its reserves. That, in turn, could increase their market capitalization by 40 to 60%, obviously a boon to shareholders. No company management could do other than join in planning for such a possibility. Iraq watcher Paul, from his perch near the United Nations, told a TV interviewer in 2004 that because the US and UK oil giants were so worried about their futures, it's really only through that lens that we can understand both the present situation and what's been happening in Iraq over quite a substantial period of time. James Akins, the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, likewise commented in early 2003 that what they, the Bush administration, have in mind is denationalization, and then parceling Iraqi oil out to American oil companies. The American oil companies are going to be the main beneficiaries of this war. However, centrist commentators were more likely to describe the pre-war viewpoint of big oil companies as defensive. One progressive tilting analysis concluded by citing the views of consultants, diplomats, and company executives that the large U.S. firms were torn between greed and fear. If all went well, they wanted to be at the table when the spoils were divided, but they feared that a fiasco could turn Middle Eastern opinion against the United States and the American oil companies. 6 months after the U.S. invasion, when Iraqi output shrank in the face of relentless sabotage of pipelines and facilities by Iraqi insurgents, Saudi Arabia stunned industry observers by giving a big gas development contract to French Total instead of ExxonMobil. The Saudis, it seemed, were displaying their annoyance over U.S. behavior. The U.S. energy industry had given George W. Bush more money in 2000 than it had to all the previous 1992 and 1996 contenders combined because of the stakes and GOP responsiveness to the oil industry. But nothing about his career in the Texas oil industry suggested that he was a deep-thinking global strategist, a skepticism justified by the outcome of the 2003 invasion with respect to both Iraqi oil production, down, and global oil prices, up. Despite the extent to which the fate of the U.S. dollar was also tied to the Iraqi oil showdown and jeopardized by failure, it received little attention in the American mass media. A rare exception came shortly after the U.S. incursion, when Newsweek described the bad blood between American and European, French and German, policymakers in terms of currency and monetary rivalry. The real clash was not over weapons of mass destruction, wrote correspondent Howard Feynman, but over the dollar versus the euro. Who gets to sell and buy Iraqi oil, and what form of currency will be used to denominate the value of the sales? That decision, in turn, will help decide who controls Iraq, which, in turn, will represent yet another skirmish in a growing global economic conflict. This, as noted earlier, was the third countdown. Major publications in Europe, much more candid, made frequent reference to the currency stakes, perceiving the U.S. dollar at loggerheads with the euro, in what the Daily Telegraph reported some observers calling a global realignment stemming from the Iraq War, which threw Russia, Germany, and France together into a new triple entente. As we will see, Russian President Putin had already discussed pricing oil in euros, not dollars, with German Chancellor Schroeder in 2002. From the U.S. standpoint, Iraq by 2002 and 2003 was a rogue nation, not just because of hidden weapons or attempts to undercut the United States in the oil arena, but also because Saddam Hussein sought to unhorse the dollar in the global financial markets. Closely on the heels of the euro's 1999 introduction, Baghdad had started trading its oil for euros, not dollars, a policy that became official in late 2000. There are no records, but Cheney's reported early 2001 plotting against OPEC may well have touched on the related peril to the dollar. Indeed, shortly after Iraq was occupied, U.S. administrators put it back on the dollar standard for its oil transactions in June 2003. Moreover, had the hoped-for flooding of world markets by Iraqi production been able to weaken or break OPEC, that would simultaneously have undercut any chance that Iran, Venezuela, and Indonesia might convince the cartel to drop the dollar for the euro, or a so-called basket of currencies. Although the newly hatched European currency had lost ground against the dollar in 2000 and 2001 as rising U.S. interest rates drew foreign investors, the euro gained in late 2002 as U.S. rates fell and Washington mobilized against Iraq. Some currency analysts in Europe, however, preferred to credit OPEC members' anti-dollar machinations instead of the U.S. interest rate changes. Venezuela, for one, promoted barter arrangements instead of dollar transactions in selling its oil to Western Hemisphere nations, in response to the alleged 2002 U.S. coup attempt against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Iran's central bank began shifting its reserves from dollars into euros. When in 2003 the U.S. takeover of Iraq bogged down in guerrilla warfare, attacks on oil installations, and escalating U.S. military casualties, those embarrassments spurred oil-related plans by some foreign nations to move into euros. Pertamina, the Indonesian state oil company, had announced that it was considering dropping the dollar even as the invasion occurred. In June, the Prime Minister of Malaysia publicly encouraged his country's oil and gas exporters to price in euros, while the Iranian central bank shifted more reserves and suggested to Asian traders that oil be paid for in euros. Moreover, after encouragement by the European Union, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced in a joint press conference with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder that Russia was considering selling its oil for euros. Part 3 of this book, dealing with the U.S. debt and dollar predicaments, will extend and amplify these challenges. For now, suffice it to say that in 2002 and 2003, dollar protection posed a serious problem. While the U.S. Navy could dominate the Persian Gulf or the waters off West Africa, its battleships were not free to train their 16-inch guns on foreign central banks. Besides the oil peak issue, U.S. oil company reserves, and the dollar's fate, the fourth endgame reflected climate change fears ranging from sober to apocalyptic. Here, environmentalists were beginning to see a countdown. The late 19th century West had suffered its own environmental fouling, the reeking smoke and haze of industrial Britain, the tons of horse manure dropped onto the streets of New York City and London. But the 20th century, with its eight-fold greater consumption of hydrocarbons and thousands of new chemical syntheses, massively increased the atmosphere's carbon dioxide content, which in turn trapped heat. One international response was the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, unacceptable to Congress and then the Bush administration because of the constraints it would have imposed on large-scale U.S. carbon dioxide emissions, while leaving nations like India and China unaffected. Climate change itself became a possible strategic and economic wildcard, even though the 2003 report by the Defense Department's in-house think tank looking at a window of peril between 2010 and 2020 was dismissed by the Bush administration. The constituency that elected the Bush regime all but barred a serious response. Congressional Democrats had also doubted Kyoto, but the Republican Party's de facto hydrocarbon coalition gloried in its SUVs and generally scoffed at switching to a conservationist or environmental mode. Even so, the entrenched petroleum and automotive interests of Houston and Detroit, as well as the combat-focused U.S. defense industries, were relative sophisticates compared to the 30 or 40% of the GOP electorate who believed in the inerrancy of the Bible. By this point, the reader may find the notion of five countdowns hard to follow. But the significance goes beyond the occasion of how oil geologists, big oil executives, currency watchers, climatologists, and evangelicals all had stopwatches ticking toward crises or great events, which drove their biases and calculations. There is also the potential for an incendiary convergence if, a big if to be sure, several of the worrywart camps prove to be correct. Geologists and investment bankers who preach peak oil timelines see per-barrel prices well above $100, and 2010 is a much-referenced date. As we will see in Part 3, some who observe financial and currency markets see a speculative credit bubble, a housing bubble, and $4 trillion of U.S. international indebtedness triggering a crisis within much the same time frame. Particularly concerned climatologists talk about the 2010s. Federal deficit watchers, in turn, cite the $30 trillion needed to fund the future of Medicare and the inability to be completely sure of Social Security solvency past 2018. I can't remember anything like this multiplicity of reasonably serious calculations and warnings. It is as if the United States, like the poet Oliver Wendell Holmes's One Hoss Shay, is about to lose all its wheels at once. If one or two of the four are correct, major troubles lie ahead. True-believing Christians, also convinced of a world entering the end times, at least see a joyful ending for themselves, if not for everyone else. Lumped together, these stressful time frames have to be taken somewhat seriously, even if most people would prefer not to put them all on one great foreboding chart. End times prophecy fueled a fifth dynamic at work as the forces for the Iraqi invasion gathered, because many Christian fundamentalists dismissed worries about oil or global warming out of belief that the end times were underway. The Bible lands were what mattered. Events were in God's hands. Even Senator James Inhofe, the Oklahoma fundamentalist chairing the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, was reported saying, "I don't believe there is a single issue we deal with in government that hasn't been dealt with in the scriptures," while declining to discuss his belief in the imminence of end times. Partly as a result, GOP political strategists had no desire for a far-reaching debate on either global warming or peak oil. The religious right had its own rapture chronometers and apocalypse monitors reporting how many months, days, and hours remained. And Tom DeLay of Texas, the Republican majority leader in the House of Representatives and widely regarded as the most influential fundamentalist in Congress, had on his office wall a poster that read, "This could be the day." This true believer endgame has been accelerating for many decades, especially since the creation of Israel satisfied the biblical prophecy of the Jewish return to Palestine. As we will see shortly, the growth during the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s in the numbers of Protestant fundamentalists, evangelicals, and Pentecostals was explosive. Many became Republicans and helped to give the GOP an increasingly religious coloration. Although the stunning sales of the Left Behind series grabbed most of the cultural attention, other books and videos during the late 90s described how Saddam Hussein was rebuilding Babylon, the citadel of evil. Still others pondered whether the Antichrist was already alive and who he might be. Saddam himself was a frequent choice. Nearly one quarter of Americans polled in 2002 even believed that the Bible had predicted the events of September 11, 2001. While these beliefs were surely a factor in Republican invasion planning, they are difficult for politicians to acknowledge. And they are especially tricky to discuss publicly, so they are instead quietly promoted in clandestine briefings or loosely signaled by phrases and citations that reassure to the attentive faithful. The final chapters of this book will revisit the U.S. global overreach and the economic vulnerability writ large in White House willingness to remain aggressively but ineptly dependent on oil. The economic, military, and financial parallels between America today and previous leading world powers are eerie. However, we will first look at the evolution and politics of Southern-dominated religious radicalism in the United States, and then at the dangers that such excesses pose for America and the world. Part 2. Too Many Preachers. Chapter 4. Radicalized Religion, as American as Apple Pie. Since at least 1776, the upstart sects have grown as the mainline American denominations have declined. And this trend continues unabated as new upstarts continue to push to the fore. Roger Fink and Rodney Stark, The Churching of America, 1992. It is impossible to locate a period of American history when so-called small sects were not growing at a faster clip than denominations then viewed as large and stable. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans, 1986. The place of the United States as the world's only remaining superpower magnifies the importance of the Christian history of North America. The spread of American influence around the world has meant that American versions of the nature, purpose, and content of the Christian faith have also spread widely. Mark A. Knoll, The Old Religion in a New World, 2002. Few questions will be more important to the 21st century United States than whether Renaissance religion and its accompanying political hubris will be carried on the nation's books as an asset or as a liability. While sermons and rhetoric propounding American exceptionalism proclaim religiosity an asset, a somber array of historical precedents, the pitfalls of imperial Christian overreach from Rome to Britain, tip the scales toward liability. Christianity in the United States, especially Protestantism, has always had an evangelical, which is to say missionary, and frequently a radical or combative streak. Some message has always had to be preached, punched, or proselytized. Once in a while, that excitability has been economic, most notably in the case of the social gospel of the 1890s, which searched through Scripture to document the Jesus who emphasized caring for the poor and hungry. In the 20th century, though, religious zeal in the United States usually focused on something quite different. Individual pursuit of salvation through spiritual rebirth, often in circumstances of sect-driven millenarian countdowns to the so-called end times and an awaited return of Christ. These beliefs have often been accompanied by great revivals, emotionalism, eccentricities of quaking, shaking, and speaking in tongues, characterization of the Bible as inerrant, and wild-eyed invocation of dubious prophecies in the Book of Revelation. No other contemporary Western nation shares this religious intensity and its concomitant proclamation that Americans are God's chosen people and nation. George W. Bush has averred this belief on many occasions. In its recent practice, the radical side of U.S. religion has embraced cultural anti-modernism, war hawkishness, Armageddon prophecy, and in the case of conservative fundamentalists, a demand for governments by literal biblical interpretation. In the 1800s, religious historians generally minimized the sectarian thrust of religious excess, but recent years have brought more candor. The evangelical, fundamentalist, sectarian, and radical threads of American religion are being proclaimed openly and analyzed widely, even though bluntness is frequently muted by a pseudo-tolerance, the polite reluctance to criticize another's religion. Given the wider thrust of religion's claims on public life, this hesitance falls somewhere between unfortunate and dangerous. Charles Kimball, a North Carolina Baptist and professor of religion, speaks very much to the point. Although many of us have been taught it is not polite to discuss religion and politics in public, we must quickly unlearn that lesson. Our collective failure to challenge presuppositions, think anew, and openly debate central religious concerns affecting society is a recipe for disaster. Still, the challenge is gathering, Academic projects that spotlight the resurgence of religious fundamentalism around the world now routinely include the United States, along with India, Israel, and many Islamic countries. Scholars have always touched on militantly anti-modernist Protestant evangelicalism, but there is a renewed focus. Some moderate to liberal theologians have begun to challenge half-baked preaching about the rapture and the end times as a toxin endangering the health, even the life, of the Christian churches and American society. Suburban megachurches, in turn, find themselves explained as offering the spiritual equivalent of a shopping mall. Would you like psychic healing today, Hindu breathing exercises, or just a little observant mood music? Ultimately, the larger political resurgence of historically controversial religiosity is what demands attention. The evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal denominations began the new millennium verging on juggernaut status. To the surprise of some observers, the sectarianism and fragmentation of American Christianity remained as visible at the turn of the 21st century as they had been 100 years earlier. A consensus on this development is taking shape, as we will see. The old mainline churches have been culturally and institutionally displaced by a new plurality. Yesteryear's supposed fringes are taking over American Protestantism's main square. Documentation is far from perfect, and statistics can be as misleading or obscure in this realm as in any other. The half dozen or so periodic religious surveys, membership directories, and atlases of religion published in the United States are useful but incomplete, in part because of the unwillingness of many small and mid-sized denominations to participate in religious samplings. The Atlas of Religious Change in America, 1952 to 1990, begins with several pages to explain its methodologies and omissions. In a nutshell, only 80 to 85% of religious adherents were included because scores of churches, mostly white, conservative, or black, did not cooperate or submitted unsatisfactory data. Fully presenting them would only enlarge the biblical and conservative predominance. In contrast to the secular and often agnostic Christianity dominant in Europe, Canada, and Australia, the American view encompasses a very different outlook, one in which a large minority is in key ways closer to the intensity of 17th century Puritans, Presbyterian Covenanters, and earlier Dutch or Swiss Calvinists. As we will see, these are not comforting analogies. The world's leading economic and military power is also, no one can misread the data, the world's leading Bible-reading crusader state, immersed in an Old Testament of stern prophets and bloody Middle Eastern battlefields. There is, to be sure, a large and growing secular culture in the United States. Among Northern University graduates and cultural elites, it is dominant, stronger by far than that of the biblical and salvationist contingent. However, the Republican coalition and administration of George W. Bush is heavily weighted toward the 30 to 40% of the electorate caught up in Scripture and the prospect of being suddenly transported to God's side. This is enough to push the United States toward what Chapter 6 will posit as a national disenlightenment. Indeed, American foreign policy has its own corollary to the end times worldview. The preemptive righteousness of a biblical nation become a high-technology, gospel-spreading superpower. Chart 1 details several of the most striking public faces of this extraordinary American belief system. Against this backdrop, Christianity's unusual evolution in North America does indeed merit more attention, as religious historians such as Mark Knoll contend, than sophisticated elites in London, Paris, Beijing, or New Delhi, or for that matter in New York, Washington, and Los Angeles, have so far extended. While American religious tendencies toward parochialism and moral or political crusades mattered little in 1890, 1914, or even during the Cold War, they take on much greater importance now as Christian, Jewish, and Muslim holy lands occupy absolute center stage in world politics and as sites of military confrontation. The idea of the United States as a biblically spurred great power, which has been framed by historians such as Walter McDougall in Promised Land Crusader State, 1997, has had unforeseen relevance to the Bush administration and cannot be cavalierly dismissed. Historically, great powers have too often gone out in blazes of religious invocation. The newly Christian 4th-century Rome of the Emperor Constantine and his successors held up the cross as Rome faced military defeat and crumbling frontiers from Hadrian's Wall to Assyria. So did 17th-century Spain, the proud but ill-omened command post of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Vestments of crusaderdom also cloaked Imperial Britain's overreach in World War I and its aftermath. Those uncomfortable precedents will be elaborated upon in later chapters. First, however, we will take on the prominence and many flavors of religious radicalism in the United States, truly as American as apple pie. Chart 1. The American People, a Biblical Worldview. The Bible, a Literal Truth. Newsweek poll, December 2004. Is the Bible literally accurate? National sample, yes, 55%. Evangelical Protestants, yes, 83%. Non-evangelical Protestants, yes, 47%. Catholics, yes, 45%. Christianity, in what do you personally believe? God, Newsweek poll, 2000, 94%. Gallup poll, 2004, 80%. Fox News poll, 2004, 92%. Miracles, Newsweek poll, 2000, 84%. Fox News poll, 2004, 82%. Heaven, Gallup poll, 2004, 81%. Fox News poll, 2004, 85%. Angels, Gallup poll, 2004, 78%. Fox News poll, 2004, 78%. Hell, Gallup poll, 2004, 77%. Fox News poll, 2004, 78%. Satan, the devil. Newsweek poll, 2000, 75%. Gallup poll, 2004, 70%. Fox News poll, 2004, 70%. Belief in highlights of the Bible. ABC Primetime Poll. Are these descriptions literally true? Noah's Ark? Yes, 60%. God's creation of Earth in 6 days? Yes, 61%. God parting the Red Sea for Moses? Yes, 64%. The Book of Revelation and the Coming of Armageddon. Will events in the Book of Revelation occur sometime in the future or not? CNN Time, 2002. All Christians? Yes, 59%. No, 33%. Born again, fundamentalist, and evangelical categories? Yes, 77%. No, 15%. Will the world end in an Armageddon battle between Jesus Christ and the Antichrist? Newsweek, October 1999. All Christians? Yes, 45%. No, 39%. Evangelical Protestants? Yes, 71%, no, 18%. Other Protestants, yes, 28%, no, 54%. Catholics, yes, 18%, no, 57%. The Sect-Driven Dynamic of American Religion. Part of the unusual sectarian quality of U.S. Protestantism derives from its cultural parentage. Britain, itself once a biblical nation, convinced it was God's chosen one, was unlike other European powers in a willingness to populate the American colonies with scripture-reading religious dissenters. The resultant flow from Britain and Europe helped to stamp the North American colonies as a religious refuge. For English and Welsh Puritans, Baptists and Quakers, Scottish and Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, Jews from many parts of Europe, French Huguenots, and a myriad of German speakers fleeing continental wars. Moravians, Palatines, Amish, Mennonites, Anabaptists, Dunkers, and Salzburgers. Especially in the middle colonies, New York and Pennsylvania, the result was a population that exhibited the religiosity of refugee faith across a kaleidoscope of denominations and sects. Following independence, this all but mandated tolerance and ruled out any official church in these states. Only relatively homogeneous New England kept official congregational churches in three states: Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. While many foreign visitors commented on this national trait, high religiosity and tolerance seemingly buoying each other, fewer remarked on a related belief pattern. With choice of worship permitted, late 18th and early 19th century American Protestants, among the world's most Bible-reading, flocked to the sort of individualist and anti-hierarchical faith that emphasized a personal relationship with God. This made them responsive to pioneering evangelists such as English visitor George Whitefield during the so-called Great Awakening of the 1740s and to others during the Second Great Awakening of the early 1800s. Periodic revivalism, in turn, fed a still resonant exodus of Americans from established churches that had given up a motion for respectability, turning instead to movements or sects that emphasized salvation, spirituality, physical displays, founders' claims to special revelation, Mormons, for example, faith healing, and holiness upon the land. Over the years, new waves of fervor, zeal, and agitation, from quakes, shakes, and jerks to millennial watchkeeping and speaking in tongues, have sparked almost continuous cultural and behavioral comment from domestic and foreign observers. In one of the latest non-traditional evolutions, third wave Pentecostalism, hundreds of churches have replaced organ music with guitars, drums, and synthesizers, some adding unusual new forms of personal expression and spiritualism. Mark Knoll, one of America's foremost religious historians, in 2002 wrote the book The Old Religion in a New World, explaining the differences in Christianity in Europe and in North America. The major divergences go to the heart of what is unusual about American religion. As might be expected, the United States has a superabundance of denominations and sects compared to Europe, as well as a far higher ratio of churchgoers. By one count, the United States in 1996 had 19 separate Presbyterian denominations, 32 Lutheran, 36 Methodist, 37 Episcopal or Anglican, 60 Baptist, and 241 Pentecostal. Globalization and immigration have added to the proliferation in surprising ways. In A New Religious America, 2001, Diana Eck pointed out that Muslims in America outnumber Presbyterians or Episcopalians, and that Los Angeles is the most varietal Buddhist city in the world. Each Sunday, the Los Angeles Times publishes a directory of services that includes more than 600 denominations. To add to the complexity, theological cross-currents are sapping the old denominations and making their labels less meaningful. In Knoll's words, free-flowing Pentecostal and charismatic styles will go on spreading their influence far beyond the explicitly Pentecostal churches. The most important Christian schisms will increasingly follow theological, ideological lines rather than denominational lines. Especially as the historic Catholic-Protestant chasm continues to narrow, Christians will be linked to fellow believers from other denominations according to shared convictions. Examples of this emerging trans-denominationalism include the growth of the new suburban megachurches, some boasting congregations of 10 to 15,000, and the post-Pentecostal networks of Calvary Chapels and the Association of Vineyard Churches. Also to the point, U.S. Protestantism uniquely abounds with what Knoll terms populist innovations, or forms of worship developed by laypeople. One is the widespread American embrace of dispensational premillennialism, a fervor launched in the 19th century around biblical passages interpreted to signal the second coming of Christ. A second, Pentecostalism, is based on the latter rain of revival in the Holy Spirit prophesied in Joel 2:23. To Pentecostals, the defining sign of an individual's possession by the Holy Spirit is the gift of tongues, the ability to utter words and sentences intelligible only to God and those with the gift of interpretation. Knoll acknowledges that neither dispensationalism nor Pentecostalism has ever appeared respectable in academic environs, but each has attracted far more adherence and driven far more practical religious activity than any academically respectable theology of the 20th century. Although survey results vary, some 7 to 10% of U.S. churchgoers appear to be Pentecostals, and perhaps a quarter of churchgoers are full-fledged end-times believers, as opposed to the 50% or so who relate to the symbolism when holy wars or tsunamis dominate the news. Conversion on the part of adults, the deep personal experience of being born again in Christ, is also far more important in the United States, with its emphasis on individual choice and personal experience, than elsewhere. In the mid-1980s, some 33% of respondents told the Gallup poll they had been born again. By the early 2000s, the number had climbed to 44 to 46%. George W. Bush's own tale of coming to God struck a chord in the church-going United States that would have been impossible in less observant Europe. Even in kindred Canada, supposedly no prime minister has ever claimed to be born again. Likewise, notably American is the pervasive influence of the Bible, from the first English migrations a staple of belief and interpretation. Bible publishing in the New Republic quickly became an industry. Some 1,800 different English language editions were published between 1777 and 1865, and remains one today, with more than 7,000 editions available as of 1990. National attentiveness to Scripture, in turn, helps to explain the unusual popular commitment to biblical inerrancy, prophecy, and the supposed end times. A related topic, the recurrent conflict between religiosity and science, reflects how much American thinking has been steeped in both. Tensions between the Book of Genesis and Darwinian theories of evolution, brought to a theatrical and political head in 1925 in Tennessee's famous Scopes trial, still throb. The result, concludes Knoll, has been a much greater salience in America concerning evolution and creation science than in any other Western society. Sociologists Rodney Stark and Roger Fink, in their pioneering study, The Churching of America, 1776 to 1990, provide a revealing explanation of America's religious idiosyncrasies. The religious history of the United States, they say, rests heavily on sectarian emotion and revival, a process underway since the 18th century in which churches become establishmentarian, compromise their errand into the wilderness, and then lose their organizational vigor, eventually to be replaced by less worldly groups, whereupon the process is repeated. Even by the time of the American Revolution, the old colonial elite denominations, Congregationalists in New England, Quakers in Pennsylvania, and Anglicans from Chesapeake Bay and to the South, were in places being challenged or overtaken by upstart Baptists and Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. By 1850, revival-minded Methodists and Baptists, with their itinerant preachers, circuit riders, and camp meetings, ranked first and second nationally. By the early 20th century, Baptists had pulled ahead, with Pentecostal, Charismatic, Restorationist, Holiness, and other sects gaining traction. The colonial-era elite denominations kept slipping down the list, holding ever smaller ratios of U.S. worshipers. By the end of the 20th century, the fundamentalist-leaning Southern Baptist Convention, wedded to biblical inerrancy, was by far the largest Protestant group. Indeed, as we will see in greater detail, the SBC, together with other once peripheral sects, boasted some 40 million adherents versus a combined 15 million members of the four leading mainline churches, Methodist, Episcopal, Presbyterian, and Church of Christ Congregational. Like Stark and Fink, historian Knoll observed that previously marginal groups have become larger and more important, while previously central denominations have moved toward the margins. The Protestant bodies whose rates of growth in recent decades have exceeded general population increases, sometimes far exceeded, are nearly all characterized by such labels as Bible-believing, born-again, conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist, holiness, Pentecostal, or restorationist. While avoiding judgmental descriptions, Stark and Fink did insist on the primary feature of our religious history. The mainline bodies are always headed for the sideline. Sectarianism keeps claiming center stage, reinforcing or reinventing the radical aspects of American religion. The ever-expanding American revival tent. As the 21st century began, none of the Western countries in which Reformation Protestantism bred its radical or anarchic sects nearly 500 years earlier, England, Scotland, Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, still had congregations of any great magnitude adhering to that theology. Even sympathetic commentators have described church attendance in England with phrases such as catastrophic decline, and a recent survey of students at Belgium's ancient Catholic University in Leuven found only 16% crediting the resurrection of Christ and a mere 3% believing in the infallibility of the Pope. The United States, religiously inspired and settled by some of those same radical Protestant sects in the 1600s and early 1700s,